So good morning, everyone. How great to see you all. I'm feeling a little rusty on all these procedures and devices since I have not been here for a whole month. As some, but perhaps not all of you know, I took the month of January off for what I called an at-home sabbatical. So I didn't really go anywhere. I've been here the whole time. And I knew it wouldn't be the same as going away somewhere away from the never-ending at-home to-do list. But what I didn't anticipate when I made this plan was the Omicron surge, which had necessitated us going back on only Zoom for our practice, so that the Zoom Zendo here, this is Blue Mountain Zendo, where Michael and I live between Maple Ridge and Mission, that Mountain Rain would be Zooming from here while I was doing my at-home sabbatical, which had the strange effect of making me feel like I was banished upstairs, even though it's what I chose. It was odd. So I was putting on earphones. But the good thing about doing my sabbatical in this way is that it showed me how to structure and give time to a kind of inner space in the midst of my messy household and other things going on. And actually, a number of people told me something similar when we've had to do our intensive week-long sesshin without a zendo, and people practicing at home. And they said, well, it was different, it was harder in some ways, and yet it showed me how to make that space in my home with more confidence and, you know, a measure of what we tend to call discipline. You know, discipline has a bad rap, you know, because we think it's all about punishment. But discipline in terms of an inner commitment, you know, to what's important for us. And it's so easy to, you know, to let other things take precedence. So in that sense, it was good for me. It, you know, I did manage to mostly stick to my resolve. Knowing how important it was for me at this point, you know, approaching the 2 year point of the pandemic, to just really take some time to step back and be with my heart and mind, and to attend to those places that we all have of perhaps some deep grief, it's different for each of us, you know, what's there beneath the cover story, the despair or the anger or the fear. But I could tell that there was a cumulative effect upon me in terms of, that was evidenced by not so great sleep, exacerbated by an old cat who's doing a sort of cat version of sundowning, you know, like people with dementia have, where he, just as we're nodding off, he starts doing these strange yowls. Not great sleep, that kind of clutching sensation around the heart that would come at the slightest prompt, or sometimes for no reason evident. And there was no one factor in this cumulative effect. It was everything, right? The insanity in the country of my birth, which is just south of the border from us. It's, you know, keeping everything going for Mountain Rain. racial violence and injustice, climate change, the pandemic, of course, and, the death of both my parents. Now, they were 96 and 95, so their deaths were not unanticipated. And in a way, that loss was subsumed by the pandemic. So when my mom died in that first COVID wave in her nursing home, 3,000 miles away, I was with all those other people who couldn't be with their loved ones. You know, there was this sense of how big this was. It was a very small part of this big thing. So it wasn't really until Michael and I went back back east in October, and my clan of cousins gathered for a memorial for both my parents at the old hometown and the old cemetery there. In the wake of that, I think, and up to the holidays, I finally really took in or did that kind of life review, you know, that those of you who've lost elderly parents have probably experienced, that where you look back and you think about their lives and their traumas and what's been passed on and what's been the gifts and the traumas. So I really needed to attend to some of that. The full catastrophe. Do folks remember the name of that Jon Kabat-Zinn book, The Full Catastrophe, kind of launched the mindfulness movement? That was about his early work with people who were struggling with chronic pain and that was had not responded to conventional pain treatments. And, you know, from that work, you know, amazing, extensive work has extended in many different fields. And there's, you know, glossy mindfulness magazines at the Savon. Have you seen them? my jaw kind of drops every time I see them. And then I look at them, there's all these kind of airbrushed, beautiful people doing mindfulness. And I think, you know, that's okay. That's good. That's good. But there's more to it, of course, as we know. And you may remember that Kabat-Zinn titled his book, Full Catastrophe Living, I'm just making sure that the laptop is plugged in. That he took the title from a line spoken by Zorba the Greek in the movie based on the novel Zorba the Greek by Nikos Kazantzakis. And Zorba's young friend asks him, "Have you ever been married?" And Zorba replies, "Am I not a man? Of course I've been married. Wife, house, kids, everything. The full catastrophe." Now that at first might sound like one of those man jokes. Oh yeah, yeah, marriage and family, big catastrophe, right? But I wondered if Kazantzakis had been born Nicola, what novel she would have written about an eccentric old woman who might have said, "Am I not a woman? Yes, I've been married, husband, house, kids, everything, the full catastrophe." So the point is, the message is, life is a big catastrophe. Or it certainly can seem like that. That's the Buddha's first noble truth. Of course, life is marked by suffering. But the Buddha never actually said, life is nothing but suffering. The Buddha wanted us to be free from suffering and to know the sweetness and beauty of life as well. But we humans are continually trying to find a way to avoid suffering, to conquer suffering, to find meaning in suffering, to find a way to live a meaningful life in the midst of suffering, and to find that sweetness and beauty right in the middle of the full catastrophe. And there are times when we feel like the world is falling apart. I don't need to list the reasons for you. And there are times when it seems like your personal life is falling apart, and there are many possible reasons for that. And especially when those reasons start to converge, the personal and the world, which of course they are inextricably interwoven, our personal lives and our social and world lives. So I was reflecting on the events of recent years, and Michael reminded me of a koan that I gave a talk about. And I tried to remember, when was that? You know, how pre-COVID things are kind of misty. And so I had to look it up. I thought, no, I think that was Loon Lake. So I looked in my Dharma talk file and under Loon Lake, and there it was, 2016. It was right after Donald Trump was elected that I gave a talk on case 30 from the Book of Serenity. So I'm going to read that koan to you. And then I'm going to quote myself. Isn't that awful? Some things that I said in 2016. So a monk asked Dasue, when the fire at the end of the kalpa of a kalpa rages through and the whole universe is destroyed, is this destroyed or not? So for folks who don't know what a kalpa is a just unimaginably long length of time. And it goes back to pre-Buddhist lore and Hindu lore about world cycles. You know, a universe, a world comes into being, endures, and then ends. So countless kalpas after kalpas. So in Buddhist literature, you often hear about kalpas coming and going. So, when the end of a kalpa rages through and the whole universe is destroyed, is this destroyed or not? And Dasui answered, destroyed. Well, the monk was kind of alarmed and asked, then it goes along with that? And Dasue said, it goes along with that. And then the monk went and asked another teacher. This is, you know, a second opinion. Often you get a Zen, a second opinion in these koans. And the monk asked Longji, When the fire ending the eon rages through the whole universe and the whole universe is destroyed, is this destroyed or not? Longji said, not destroyed. The monk asked, why is it not destroyed? Longji said, because it is the same as the universe. Well, that's confusing, as koans tend to be. Yeah. So here's what I said in 2016, right after Donald Trump was elected. It's easy to think in apocalyptic terms these days, isn't it? As if we weren't worried enough about war, famine, dislocation, climate change, economic and social instability and injustice. And we all know those ills boil down to greed, hatred, and delusion, as the Buddha taught. As if we didn't have enough to worry about, we now have to worry about the harm a Donald Trump administration could do in a short time. This is truly a terrifying prospect, and no doubt people all over the world share our feelings. Well, when I said that, I certainly didn't imagine the last couple of years. And yet, we humans have experienced dark times many, many, many times. Even without whole universes coming into and passing out of beings, civilizations have come into being and passed away. Empires have crumbled many times. And the old Japanese and Chinese Zen masters lived through some of those times. And you can hear echoes of that in their words. So I wonder if that monk who asked about the great Kalpa fire maybe wasn't so much worried about the end of the universe after an unimaginably long time, but about the destruction and suffering maybe that he was witnessing in his own world at that time. Maybe he was not so different from us. So what is that this that he's asking about? Is it destroyed too? The koan doesn't say, and neither does the commentary. But in Zen language, it, or this, just this, often is pretty much synonymous with Buddha nature. The nature of being. The nature of being and non-being. The it of Dongshan, when he crossed the stream and saw his reflection and said, "You are not it, in truth it is you." It is the ultimate, vast, impermanent, interconnected nature within which we and all phenomena pass in and out of existence. So one Zen master said, yes, it's destroyed, and one says, no, it's not. Why? Because it's the same as the universe. So they leave us with, you know, one of these core Zen paradoxes, both true, both false. Neither one nor the other. There's a good story behind this story. Apparently the monk's question alludes to a sutra called the Sutra on the Benevolent King Safeguarding the Nation. So there was once a king called King Kamashapada who believed that it would extend his reign and the fortune of his kingdom to behead 1,000 kings, to sacrifice them to the great Mahakala, the great black, dark god. Anything for more power, right? So one of these kings that was going to, lining up to be beheaded begged a day's reprieve to provide a meal for 100 Dharma teachers. And the very first Dharma teacher offered a verse for the king, which began, "In the raging of the Kalpa fire, the whole universe is destroyed." Then it went on for many, many more lines. And as the king, who was about to be beheaded, recited this verse for the other condemned kings, Kamashapada found out and went and started listening. And he started feeling a little nervous. And so he asked to hear the whole verse. And when he did, his mind and heart were opened. He gave up his kingdom and became a follower of the Buddha way. So sometimes we wish we could recite a verse about the great Kalpa fire to a few world leaders. Right around now. You might think, oh, well, we're not kings. They wouldn't listen to us. And some of them wouldn't. We were just having a conversation last night about the difficulty of having, you know, having a conversation with someone who's holding so tightly to a view, you know, about the entrenched, you know, the vaccine mandate views, for example. You know, how do you penetrate? How do you find common ground? But actually, ordinary people like us have more voice, more access to the ears of the mighty than ever before. And so people all over the world are coming up with creative ways to communicate their deep wishes for a more peaceful and just way of living on this earth with each other and all beings. And sometimes the way to do that isn't by that sort of confrontational argument and throwing facts at each other. It's by touching something deeper, you know, our love for our children, you know, taking care of of taking care of what's right in front of us. And sometimes it's using different languages than the language of facts. And so using the language of song, images, poetry, music, food, sharing food. Don't you miss sharing food with friends? You know? Potlucks! May the potlucks come again. There's another version of this koan in which the monk asks, "It is said that the great kalpa fire will flash and annihilate the billion worlds. Can you tell me if this very place will also be destroyed?" And Dasui said, "Yes, it will." And the monk says, "If so, will I be part of it?" And Dasui says, "Yes, you will. Your life will come to an end." Ouch! There's something very seductive about apocalyptic thinking, because it often includes a kind of fantasy that we and our loved ones and our beliefs will be miraculously spared, will be among the righteous, will be raptured up, you know, and saved, while the rest of humanity burns. Or it will be the stars of the Hollywood blockbuster who will survive the earthquake and outrun the lava and outrun the tsunami and the storm, and we'll save a few people we like. We'll never quite believe, you know, that we'll be the ones, or those we love. But the pandemic has shaken that belief for many. And for others, it has congealed denial. Sorry. What's going on? Just give me a second to make sure. Something's not plugged in. Just a sec. Okay. Plugged in more firmly. Where was I? So, in that talk, that 2016 talk, I read from a poet, one of my favorites, Nazım Hikmet, a Turkish poet, who was a political prisoner for 13 years, basically for the crime of writing a poem about a 14th century poet who wrote subversive poems. So he wrote this poem in prison, and it's called On Living. Living is no laughing matter. You must live with great seriousness, like a squirrel, for example. I mean, without looking for something beyond or and above living, I mean you must be your whole, I mean living must be your whole life. Living is no laughing matter. You must take it seriously, so much so, and to such a degree, that, for example, your hands tied behind your back to the wall, or else in a laboratory, in your white coat and safety glasses, you can die for people. Even for people whose faces you've never seen, even though you know living is the most real, the most beautiful thing. I mean, you must take living so seriously that even at 70, for example, you'll plant olive trees. And not for your children, either, but because, although you fear death, you don't believe it, because living, I mean, weighs heavier. So I don't think he means that we can't smile or have, enjoy our lives. I think he's talking about even that we must take seriously. He's talking about taking life seriously in the way Dogen says to practice as though your hair is on fire, which it doesn't mean to be stern and joyless and rigid, but to live with a vibrant intensity. I think that's the way he means this. I think he's telling us that if we are paralyzed by our fear of death and loss, we won't be able to speak or act or be of any benefit. So I think he's kind of speaking to both sides of that koan. We must know we may die today or tomorrow, and we must live fully until that moment, whenever it comes. So, poetry. Poetry has been a practice and a refuge for me this past month. I've been taking an online poetry workshop through Orion Magazine. Anybody know Orion Magazine? It's a beautiful journal. It has nonfiction, fiction, visual art, and poetry on the human, the more than human, and culture, that sort of intersection. And they have an online poetry workshop called Writing the Catastrophe with most of the focus, but not exclusive focus, on climate change, climate crisis. Because you can't actually talk about climate crisis without talking about the personal, the social, the political, all those levels, right? So we've been investigating how poetry can go beyond the facts to a more nuanced and complex expression about living in this seemingly catastrophic time. So I'm going to summon some courage and share a few things that I wrote this past month on my sabbatical with you to give you a sense of the territory that I've been inhabiting. So this is the first one. It's called Pandemic Vocabulary Practice. One thing you can do during the second year of the pandemic is expand your vocabulary. Since you've already learned spike proteins, super spreader, flattening the curve, and zoonotic, you can learn some meteorological terms. Heat dome in July, when 600 people die in your moist northwest province where few people have AC. Pyrocumulonimbus in August, fire-breathing dragon clouds, born of fire, spawning fire children. Third worst wildfire season on record. Atmospheric rivers in November, three in quick succession flooding the Fraser Valley. Sumas Prairie, once a lake, now rich farmland, until the dikes give way, drowning fields, cows, pigs, and chickens. Landslides and flash floods collapse bridges, block highways, railways, threaten the supply chain, already pandemic impaired. You may need to revive old words. In May, when 215 unmarked graves, children's graves, are discovered at the former Kamloops Indian Residential School, you can practice saying indigenous peoples. Since the Vikings weren't expecting to find India when they arrived in Newfoundland 1,000 years ago, even though they were used to harsh northern conditions, they were unable to settle on that wild Atlantic coast. Besides, if you say First Nations, it doesn't include the Inuit, Innu, and Métis, whose children died in residential schools too. You might learn there's a new word called solastalgia for the feeling of missing the way the place you are used to be. You might wonder if indigenous people have lived with that feeling all their lives. You may need to invent some new words, because you just can't keep saying heartbreak every single day. You may need to say bumblebee watering trough, because it's so hot and dry you worry about them. And they pollinate your squash. Hummer feet are warmer because there's an Arctic outflow, and Anna's hummers are in the snow are a miracle, though no one knows how much their expanded range is due to climate change and how much to people like you feeding them. First spring loon call, because they've returned from the Pacific coast to the inland lakes to breed and raise their chicks. Oh, I have a longer one than that I don't think there's time for. So I'm going to reach you. I'll save it. I'll come back to it. I may have to do that another day. It's called The Loneliness of Thawing. It's about thawing glaciers and permafrost and things. But, no, it's going to have to wait. Besides, it's a work in progress. I'm going to read you this other one, which is called Virus, You Are Us. You pair us, you prune us, you take and you give us. You're not even a living being without us. You take over the world. You look like a fuzzy cat toy if you don't care. You don't care if we're girl or boy. You're spiky with proteins that snag on soft tissues. Don't live long on surfaces. You mutate uncontrolled. You took my dear mother and so many others. I couldn't be with her at her gateway. Don't think that I blame you. We humans raised you from deep obscurity. We'll co-evolve in perpetuity. May we learn, oh, may we learn humility. So that gives you just a little taste of what I've been doing this past month. But I want to go back to the final section of the poem by Nazim Hikmet on living. There's three sections. I'm going to read you the third. This earth will grow cold, a star among stars and one of the smallest, a gilded moat on blue velvet. I mean this. Our great earth. This earth will grow cold one day, not like a block of ice or a dead cloud even, but like an empty walnut, it will roll along in pitch black space. You must grieve for this right now. You have to feel this sorrow now, for the world must be loved this much if you're going to say, I lived. We need to be able to love the world that much, knowing how short our little lives are. And that someday this world itself will be gone and other worlds will continue. And we must love without clinging. Whoa, you might think that, whoa, love without clinging, that's not so easy. And it's not, but you can do it. You do it. You do sometimes without knowing you're doing it. In that moment, you're just looking up at the moon above or the moss at your feet or the person serving you soup at the cafe or the person who stumbles and you catch them by the elbow. You're loving without clinging, without even thinking about it, right? And in the next moment, you might be clinging again. Probably you will. But in that moment, or hour, or day, you're not. You're just loving. Will it be destroyed? Yes and no. The catastrophe isn't necessarily one big Hollywood-style boom. It's human life, with all kinds of suffering, all kinds of sweetness and beauty. So we go on, we plant an apple tree, we comfort a sick child, we join with others to strengthen community, we speak truth to power. The list goes on, and the effects of what we do and say go on and on. in ways we can never know. So in that talk from 2016, I gave a list of what I called survival skills for dark times. So I'm going to repeat them. And I believe that this was, I'm not sure, I believe this was the practice period where Vicky was at Sarshuso, and she, her theme was living in this world, living with this world. How do we do it? How do we live in a world of suffering? So here's my list of survival skills. Living simply, having simple needs, taking delight in small, transient things, writing haiku about them, living in community, self-awareness, the capacity to be present with our own suffering and the suffering of others, without acting out in harmful ways, without being overwhelmed, being able to repair relationships when, as inevitably happens, they are damaged, cultivating patience, compassion, equanimity, and deep insight into the true nature of our being as impermanent, conditioned, utterly interdependent creatures. So sometimes it's good to remind yourself of what you already know. So sometimes it's good to go back and read your own Dharma talks. Or something that you wrote yourself in your journal, right? And you went, wow, did I write that? Did I know that? Wow, I forgot, you know? So sometimes it's good to do that. So that's it for today. I want to thank you all for keeping everything going, keeping this practice strong during my month away, not away. Your practice helps keep me upright and encourages me to go on. So let us go on together. Should we chant? May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. Thank you. I need to bow out, and Michael will lead you in the service. Thank you, everyone.
And we'll all move towards doing more bows. So we'll have three full bows prior to service, and today we'll be chanting the Heart Sutra and the Harmony of Difference and Equality Sutra.